Sure. What story do you want?
From 1958 until the 1970s, Jim Kopp told children's stories. He didn't write children's books, but he and his business partner, Ed Brown, created, performed, and recorded his stories in a series of children's records. Now here's a short take from a story called Martha Matilda O'Toole.
Martha Matilda O'Toole went skipping off to school, but as she was turning to go through the gate, discovered that she had forgotten her slate. Thought Martha, the teacher won't like it a bit. I'd better go get it, my mind, she did.
Martha Matilda O'Toole and two other of Jim Kopp's tales have been combined into a new book for children, complete with illustrations and an accompanying CD. It's called Jim Kopp, Will You Tell Me a Story? Our ambassador to the world of children's literature, Daniel Pinkwater, joins us from his home.
Scott!
Yes.
I have one thing to say. No, I have two things to say.
Okay.
Maybe more.
Yeah.
The first thing to say is I am wary of books that come with CDs. And I shy away from music recordings specially made for children. In general, they give me the pip. When you and I did a children's radio program a few years ago, we gave them Fats Waller and Louis Armstrong, and I think we did right.
Yeah.
So here's a book with a CD and music specially made for children, and it is great.
Now, you knew him, I gather.
I know his work. And here's the thing. Jim Kopp and his partner, Ed Brown, started producing these records in the 50s.
He was like a cabaret performer, wasn't he?
He was a cabaret performer and an intelligence officer in the war, and then he wrote a society column in a Los Angeles paper, so figure him out. And so he started doing this in his house, using three home tape recorders, and Brown played some of the characters, designed the albums, and they would take a suitcase and go around and hand sell the records to upscale stores like Neiman Marcus and Bergdorf Goodman and FAO Schwartz, and they kept this up for at least 10 years.
Oh, my gosh. Well, of course, now you and I usually read from the book, but we have the Kopp and Brown recording.
It would be a shanda or a scandal or a shame for you and I to read it when we have the actual sound.
All right, but let's listen and maybe talk a little bit about one of the stories here, Miss Goggins and the Gorilla.
Now, our story opens in the classroom of Miss Goggins, an incredibly nasty teacher.
Ugly, too, they point out.
Ugly, too. Mm-hmm. So she uses words like unruly, disobedient, and vituperative to describe the children. I love it, and kids love it when grown-up words appear in children's books. It sure takes me back to the Nettlehorst School on Broadway in Chicago.
Yes, Broadway and about Melrose?
Yep. Many of the teachers I had were very like Miss Goggins.
So can I spill the beans? A gorilla's in the classroom, right?
A gorilla shows up.
The huge animal came straight toward Miss Goggins.
Get out of here. How dare you come into my room? You aren't a real gorilla. You are only Mr. Hobson, the manual training teacher, dressed up in a gorilla suit to fool us. Get out!
Well, I think he really is a gorilla, okay? I'm taking a look at the illustrations. He doesn't look like Mr. Hobson in a gorilla suit to me. I think he's really a gorilla. But the point of it is she kicks him out.
She pushes him. She shoves him. Not even a gorilla can stand up to Miss Goggins.
Silence. That was not a real gorilla, and you are stupid children for thinking so.
I love her.
She we've all had teachers like this. So she tries to continue the lessons, but you know what? The gorilla will not be held at bay. He comes crashing through the door.
And then...
said the gorilla through the door.
Silence, Mr. Hobson.
Said the gorilla, and he came suddenly crashing through the door. And with his hairy arm swinging, came straight for Miss Goggins.
I told you to get out of my room,
said Miss Goggins.
I shall report you to the principal.
Report me to the principal, said the gorilla, removing his false head. And who do you suppose he really was? He was the principal of the school himself.
All right. Turns out he was checking on the teachers, as he always did, in disguise once a year. And because she performed so miserably, he fires her.
And out the door she flew. And it was the last the children ever saw of her. Of course, such a thing could never happen nowadays, because there aren't any more teachers like Miss Goggins, are there, children?
I can see where I can see where these were very popular, and
it's
and
so
still
satisfying.
Should be. And now we've got a note to today's children who are growing up in a world of digital audio and YouTube and TiVo. The technology might sound a little bit primitive, or does it? On the other hand, does it sound charming?
It's not that primitive when you consider that it's one guy, and various kitchen appliances, kazoos, toy pianos, and 3 Ampex tape recorders in his living room.
How does the book part hold up here?
I think it's a handsome book. I think the illustrations are right in the groove. Apparently, Lindsay DuPont, the illustrator, grew up listening to the gym. And the Jim Cop records came with little sort of like, I don't know what you call them, push-out or pop-out figures, and you could make a little cardboard theater. It was quite elaborate. The whole thing is in such good fun. I'm so pleased that we can call this to people's attention.
Daniel, thanks so much for bringing it to our attention.
Scott, it is always a pleasure, particularly this time.
Daniel Pinkwater is the author of many fine books for children and for adults. His latest book is The Egacy. And by the way, you can find an installment of it on his website, pinkwater.com. You're listening, Miss Goggins?
1,857 pages thick. And I'm glad I took it. It fits perfectly under the short leg of my pool table. It wasn't a history, I know, because it had no plot. It wasn't a mystery, because nobody there got shot. The day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm gonna do it again. Yes, one of these days I'm gonna do it again.
High school football season kicks off around the country this week, and this season, small schools have a new way of trying to keep step with larger schools that have linebackers that might make you wonder what they're giving students in their lunchroom. It's called the A-11 offense. It was developed by Coach Kurt Bryan of the Piedmont, California Highlanders. It's an offense that puts 11 possible receivers on the field, makes it easier to trick some of the Goliaths on the other side of the line of scrimmage. Last year was the first season the A-11 hit the field. Piedmont took their new playbook all the way to the playoffs. The A-11 will be tested again Saturday night in the season opener against Sir Francis Drake High School. Piedmont coach Kurt Bryan joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Coach Bryan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott, for having me on today.
Now, is there a quick way of explaining how you put, 9 potential receivers on the line?
Yeah, sure. If you're a bird looking down at a football field, you can picture 3 receivers split out wide to the left, 3 receivers split out wide to the right, a center and 2 guards or a tight end on either side of the center, and then 2 quarterbacks in the shotgun formation or a quarterback and a running back there. So we spread the field from the numbers to the numbers.
Now, isn't there some regulation? You can only have, 5 or 6 eligible receivers?
Exactly. What we did is research the rule book, and we found the key to unlock this new system of football, and it lies in the scrimmage kick formation.
So you line up the same way you would, say, for a kickoff.
Or a PAT, a punt.
A punt, or a point after touchdown, yeah, okay.
And as long as you have nobody under center, and at least one potential recipient of the long snap 7 or more yards deep in the backfield, you can then have up to all 11 players wearing an eligible jersey number.
So the defense doesn't know who to block.
Well, yeah, and the defense, more importantly, has to respect the potential threat of anybody who's wearing an eligible number on that particular play.
Does this vastly increase the number of plays you can run?
You know, it's so funny that you asked that. Scientific American just did a study, and it takes your average offensive play from about 35 possible options to over 16,000 just on one formation. It is absolutely wild what it's going to do for the game.
Now, I'm sure all of your football players are young scholars, but isn't that an awful, lot of potential plays for them to have to know?
Yeah, it is. And, you got to make sure that you keep it simple. And we had to develop a system that was kind of a cookie cutter so the coaches and players that were going to learn the A11 offense could see it, they could visualize it, it could be taught and learned at a rapid rate. So that was really critical.
Does it decrease injuries? I'm just guessing because you have less of the ka-thunk against each other.
Yeah, it really does decrease injuries. And because the players are so spread out across the field of play, there's a lot less gang tackling and a lot less what's called roll-ups. We did not suffer any major injuries last year on the offensive side of the ball due to contact.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But the game is much faster and very exciting for the fans, so everybody wins.
I have to tell you, I logged onto your website to educate myself about the A11, and it's a lot of fun.
One of the benefits that we found is that a lot of different players touch the football, and so it's easier to keep the attention of your players during practice and certainly throughout the game because they never know where the ball's coming to next play. And, you know, if you take a look at the history of football, it started as a very brutal, compacted game, and it's slowly spread out. And if you take a look down the road at where it's going, the game is only going to become faster and even more spread out. And, you know, I want to see what's going to happen over the next 10 to 20 years as football reveals itself with this new dimension.
What was your record last year, Coach?
We finished 7-3, and then we made the playoffs, and we ended the season 7-4. We lost to a champion, Las Lomas, in the playoff game.
Well, I don't envy Sir Francis Drake.
Well, we got our work cut out for us. It's going to be a tough game. We're looking forward to it.
Kurt Bryan, he's the varsity football coach for the Piedmont Highlanders in Piedmont, California. Coach Bryan, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Guitarist and songwriter Steve Cropper co-founded Booker T and the MGs and helped shape the sound of Memphis in the 1960s. Staff musician at Stax Records, Mr. Cropper co-wrote Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, Knock on Wood, and many other hits. Singer and keyboard player Felix Cavallari defined what came to be known as Blue-Eyed Soul. He was the voice of the Young Rascals on hits like Good Lovin', A Beautiful Morning, and A Girl Like You. Though their music mined much of the same territory, they've never recorded together until now. Craig Havokhurst of member station WPLN reports.
Steve Cropper and Felix Cavallari's first musical collaboration came at a distance in 1967. The Rascals had recorded a cover version of In the Midnight Hour, one of Cropper's best-known compositions and a hit for Wilson Pickett. Cropper says he was able to repay the favor after he got hold of a test pressing of a new Rascals record.
And on there they had a little song called Groovin'.
Groovin' on a Sunday afternoon.
I played it over and over and over, and I went down and I played it for the guys, and we went in the studio without permission, obviously, and cut an instrumental version of it. Their record comes out, it's a hit, it's a smash, and we put out this instrumental, and boom, ours went right up the charts.
Although they recorded for sister record companies and work with many of the same people, Cropper and Cavallari didn't actually make music together until just a few years ago. The unlikely matchmaker, Ringo Starr, who puts together touring bands of high-profile musicians to play hits from yesteryear. But songwriter and producer John Tiven, who'd hired both artists for separate sessions in the past, lobbied them to get together to work on something more consequential.
The idea was, we've got to do stuff that doesn't sound like we're just rehashing our past.
Tiven says the artists, one from Memphis and one from Long Island, have vastly different personalities. But their shared musical foundations were more than enough to bridge the gap as they began jamming together. In their first meeting at Tiven's home studio, they finished two songs, including the album opener, One of Those Days.
Mm-hmm. If I didn't know these guys as well as I do, I would have been very intimidated because their accomplishments are just extraordinary. But they're just such easy guys that you know, the three of us together in a room, it's just like Joe Blow and the Schmoes, you know, just trying to write a great song. And we never left a session without coming up with something.
Saturday morning.
Remember, Nashville is a writing town, so people get together and write all the time, spur of the moment.
Felix Cavallari says that culture drew both him and Cropper to Music City decades ago. Tiffin says nearly all of the keyboard and guitar parts on the album were preserved from those initial writing sessions, capturing, he hopes, the moment of creative conception rather than a performance off a music stand. Cavallari says they took those tracks to another studio where they were fleshed out with bass, drums, and backing vocals.
And then we realized, hey, this stuff's okay. You know, this stuff's pretty good. Let's continue. And then it became an album. Prior to that, it was just songs.
Oh, everywhere I look, I see your face. Even in the mirror, all over the place. Just when I think that I've forgotten, the thought of you come right to the top.
Neither artist had released new material under his own name for more than a decade. With years away from writing and recording original music, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that they'd be happy with the results. But Cropper says they had nobody looking over their shoulder and nothing to lose.
We started with one, and it was fun, and we continued. And I think we kept saying, thinking, I don't know if we said it, we were thinking that, well, when it doesn't become fun anymore, we'll just quit. But it never stopped being fun.
Yesterday, you left me standing in the rain. What had I done to make you leave without explaining? I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. And girl, I think you know that when I say I love you, it ain't just for show. If it was,
there's a story in the album's liner notes about Otis Redding poking his head in on a Rascal session in the 1960s so he could convince himself that Cavallari was, in fact, a white man. Today, Cropper says Cavallari still has the voice of a teenage soul singer. All the same, Cavallari discovered there were times when it was better not to sing.
You know, I mean, sometimes you write good ones and sometimes you don't write good ones.
They'd planned an all-vocals album, but Cavallari didn't like how a song called Full Moon Tonight was coming together.
I could not sing that song, and I literally hid. And Tiven, you know, I think it's a great song. I said, well, you know, you sing it. So, you know, it just shows you how things happen.
In fact, four songs became instrumentals. That helped revive some of the organ and guitar-driven Booker T and the MGs sound and let Cropper assert his own voice. All the music on Nudge It Up a Notch has one foot in the past and one in the digital now. Cropper and Cavallari couldn't have recorded an album like this in their hit-making days, layering parts onto a tiny hard drive in different studios. Cavallari says that while he loves those new tools, he is a little bewildered putting a CD out in today's very different music environment.
I have no idea what to expect. Like, I don't even know where it's going to be for sale, literally, because, you know, the places that I know of are all gone. So if we're going to be downloaded, so be it.
The artists know it's impossible to recreate the personal, social, and political chemistry that made their work of 40 years ago so potent. But it can't hurt that this new album features two artists who vividly remember a music business where work was play and colleagues were family. For NPR News, I'm Craig Havokhurst in Nashville.
And you can hear full songs from Steve Cropper and Felix Cavallari from their new album at NPR.org. It's been nearly 75 years since The Long March, that trek by Mao Zedong and his Red Army that gave birth to the People's Republic of China. But even as communism fades, China still wrestles with its past. The resilience and self-sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of marchers has long been considered legend. Elizabeth Arnold has this report about an intrepid Chinese woman, Diane Zhang, the daughter of a Red Army officer, who's just completed her own long march in an effort to better understand this history and her father.
A steady stream of brightly colored buses lumbers up and around the steep terraces above the Min River. This superhighway was once a dirt path traveled by hundreds of thousands of Red Army soldiers fleeing the nationalist armies of Chiang Kai-shek. They were ill-equipped and outnumbered. 1 in 10 survived. For generations, the Long March has been a symbol of national character. Now, on the road herself, Diane Zhang was taught as a young girl, those who marched were martyrs.
In school, they made it, you know, a very hero. It's like only God can do it. And you never thought, you know, your dad, somebody you know.
Zhang's father, now deceased, was a Long Marcher. He was an officer in the 3rd Red Army Corps, one of the few who survived the entire 6,000-mile trek. His daughter is still struggling to make sense of it.
You know, my generation was brought up in Cultural Revolution. We don't give a damn to the older generation. You're liars. You painted a perfect world. But look at what the reality is you gave us. And you got into the prison in your own party's prison. But why are you still doing it?
Her father was jailed during the chaos of the Cultural Revolution, and Zhang couldn't understand his loyalty to the party.
Until I talked to the real people, the farmers, and find out why my father, who was from a rich family, who dropped off the college and joined the revolution. That was shocking to me. It's sort of like finding your self-identity.
Through her father's diaries and letters over the last few years, Zhang has pieced together his journey to retrace his footsteps. I joined her on the Tibetan Plateau as she was trying to cross the great grassland south of the Yellow River, notable for the sheer number of soldiers who perished here from starvation. But any trace of the Long March has given way to capitalism. There's no longer any grass. It's been overgrazed by yaks. The road is under construction. And the road crew and the herders block us, demanding money to cross. A few hours and many miles later, Zhang is more welcome in the tiny farming village of Xinmin, where she has discovered a Long March survivor. We find him in a cramped, fly-infested room, surrounded by relatives. He's in a threadbare Red Army uniform, cinched by a wide leather belt. He pulls the jacket away from his thin frame to reveal a scar.
Oh, this bone was broken by the bullet.
Jean Chue is 94, and it seems painful for him to even open his eyes. He tells Zhang that it was not the fighting, but the hunger that was so hard. Crossing the grassland, he says, they tried to eat their belts.
They boiled the water and put a leather band in it and boiled it until it's soft and cut into small pieces, just chewing it.
While the Long March was a military retreat, it was also a massive propaganda tour. It was the character of the marchers that won the party new followers. Mao's soldiers were told not to harm the peasants, not to confiscate food, and to treat minorities as equals. Zhang has been to dozens of monasteries like this one here in Choji, where according to the local historian, Gui Hua, the monks all ran away when the Red Army first arrived.
But the reason she believes is they were afraid. They heard from the nationalists the Red Army was the devil. So they ran away. And they also found that the Red Army took all their props. But they also discovered when they came back, the Red Army left money for food and stuff.
It was a winning strategy for the party, an effective recruitment tool. Zhang herself has learned to be both tolerant and persuasive on her journey. Traveling by jeep on this leg of the trip, she's stopped by landslides almost daily. This time there are two, and the driver says yet again the road is impassable.
Still quite dangerous and also risky. It's a huge, just one huge rock almost blocked the whole road with plenty of the smaller ones on the both sides.
Tenacious, Zhang insists on getting through. And the next day, we cross Lazagu Pass on mules, the only way possible. It's taken years and hundreds of interviews for Zhang to retrace a march that took her father 384 days. But finally, in the historic village of Hadapu, a landmark in Long March history, Zhang comes perhaps the closest to understanding her father's cause. Hadapu is a bustling city where Mao and other top commanders finally broke the Red Army out of the mountains, grasslands, and the Tibetan regions. They were greeted with cheers and food. It was in Hadapu that Mao learned from a newspaper there was a communist force just 250 miles to the north. They would join it and turn retreat into victory, marching into Beijing in 1949, an event as significant to China as the Civil War to America. Hadapu has had high hopes for what some call red tourism. It's an oasis of history, a town solely dedicated to the memory of the march. There are monuments, plaques, even a store that sells Long March sandals.
The sign says, Gansu Province, the Red Army Shoes Factory. And he said it's all handmade. It's pretty and comfortable.
At the heart of Hadapu is a small museum with portraits of Mao. Smiling students sing Long March songs from a TV screen in the corner. It's run by historian Han Ermin, an animated scholar. Zhang is exhausted from weeks of traveling and just wants a better map. But he has something for her she least expects, a photograph and a scroll with beautiful Chinese characters on it. She's taken aback.
He says, this is my father.
And what does it say there?
Something like they experienced all the hardship and during the march. Yeah. And the only thing they will never forget is the family feeling of the people they met on the road who helped.
On a simple scroll, Zhang Eping wrote exactly what his own daughter has only recently discovered from those she's met on her journey.
As soon as they heard, I'm a daughter of Red Army. You know, they just hold my hand. Yeah. It's some kind of a connection. Yeah, it's amazing.
While Marxist ideology is no longer the heart of today's China, and controversial new histories try to separate myth from fact, Zhang believes the epic march that shaped communism still lives on in its people. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Arnold.
The English language is full of spelling traps. There's an I in friend, but don't dare pronounce it. Why does once begin with an O, not a W? Why do cough and rough both end in GH, not an F? And then why does the GH in neighbor sound like a Y? Why does psoriasis begin with a P? And what's that C doing in the middle of Tucson anyway? I could go on. Instead, we'll ask Paul Collins to. There are what amount to advocates for spelling reform. Paul Collins, our literary detective, teaches English at Portland State University, and he saw some agitated spelling reform advocates at the 80th annual Scripps National Spelling Bee. Paul joins us from Palatine Studios in Portland. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
So what's the argument reformers make? It's just too difficult to keep track of?
Pretty much. It's actually been the same argument that's been made for centuries, and it's always out of a sense of exasperation with the English language.
Can you make any generalizations about these advocates for reform?
One thing that really struck me was, for example, in the people who were picketing the spelling bee, many of them are retired educators. These are people who had spent years working with students with learning difficulties or working with immigrants who are really struggling to learn the language. And so, a lot of these efforts grow out of a sense of frustration at being able to teach the language to people who are new to it.
Are there some points that advocates of spelling reform agree upon, or are they as divided as any other group of reformers?
They've been terribly divided, and that's been one of their great problems. And I would say the reformers have really, for well over a century now, have split off into three groups. You have the simplifiers, who just want to take the most commonly misspelled words in the English language and just fix those, just to find, say, 100 or 200 words. You have the reformers, who want to reform the spelling of every word so that they're all spelled phonetically. And then you have the orthographers. These are the people that actually want to create a new alphabet to fix one sound for each character that would accurately reflect the spelling of words.
And you've pointed out recently that, in fact, reformers came close to actually winning some reform about a century ago.
In 1906, Andrew Carnegie and Teddy Roosevelt actually started to push through what became a presidential directive that U.S. government agencies had to start using reformed spelling in their documents. And there was actually an almost visceral reaction in Great Britain that Americans were somehow desecrating their language.
Do you think there's a chance of reform coming into the language?
It's interesting because it's a movement that's attracted some tremendous names over the years. Ben Franklin had his own alphabet. Charles Darwin was part of it. So was Tennyson. Later on, H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw, Mark Twain. They all lent their names and their efforts to these kind of reforms. And it's never really taken. And I think there's actually a very specific historical reason why. I think there was a point in the 1850s or 1860s when any hope of it happening stopped.
What happened?
It got funny. I think you could even pin it on one guy, Artemus Ward, who was a very popular humorist of the 1850s and 1860s. And he really popularized a form of humor where you had characters whose dialogue is rendered phonetically. And this is basically meant to indicate that they're ignorant or rubes or whatever. I think that ever since, there's been this association culturally. If you wanted to show someone as being kind of ignorant, you render their writing or their speech phonetically. And people have a great aversion to looking foolish.
Paul Collins, professor of English at Portland State University, and his article, Buzzkill, Picketing the 80th Annual Scripps National Spelling Bee, is in the September issue of The Believer. Paul, very nice to talk to you again.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. government is preparing to take over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This according to reports in the Wall Street Journal and today's New York Times. An official announcement could come as early as this weekend. NPR's John Itzty joins us. John, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Scott.
These are mortgage giants, huge financial organizations, trillions of dollars in obligation. How would a government takeover work?
Well, according to sources quoted by the Journal and Times, the government is going to put the two organizations into conservatorship under the control of their new regulator, the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Shareholders in the companies are likely to be wiped out completely or get very little for their shares. And according to the reports, the top management of the companies were told in a meeting with Treasury Secretary Paulson, Fed Chairman Bernanke, and their top regulator, James Lockhart, yesterday, that they will ultimately be removed. Mm-hmm. But the companies would continue to do business much as they have before, buying up mortgages, packaging them into securities, and then selling them to investors.
Why would the government act now?
Well, you know, there's no immediate crisis in terms of imminent collapse, as was the case in the Bear Stearns rescue back in March. But what's happened is that the housing market has continued to deteriorate. We saw that in another report yesterday from the Mortgage Bankers Association, which reported foreclosures are continuing to rise. And even in loans to prime borrowers, this is beyond subprime now. Mm-hmm. And Freddie and Fannie guarantee $5 trillion worth of mortgages, most of them these prime mortgages. And it's an ominous sign to see those safer loans going bad and contemplate what that might mean in terms of losses for the companies. The two companies have already reported billions of dollars in losses. They're having trouble raising capital to cover future losses. And the economy just can't afford to have these two giant companies, which are now responsible for making about 70% of the mortgages in the economy, they can't be allowed to fail. It would be essentially would seize up the mortgage market. Getting a mortgage, buying or selling a home would be impossible.
But doesn't a government takeover just put billions of taxpayer dollars at risk?
Well, yes, it does. But, you know, they're already at risk. The government has basically said that it backs the obligations of these companies already. And that's really how we've gotten into this trouble over the years. There's no way of knowing how much it might cost taxpayers to make good on the mortgages that are going into foreclosure, certainly in the tens of billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. But the problem with leaving these companies floundering is that financial companies in distress often take bigger and bigger risks, get themselves deeper and deeper into trouble, and officials probably feel that since the government is on the hook already, it's just time to take control and limit the losses.
Any indication about the long term for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Will the government continue to run them as government enterprises?
Well, both presidential candidates have expressed dissatisfaction with the companies in their current form. And I think because they're basically privatizing the profits and socializing the losses, as we're seeing happen right now. Mm-hmm. I think the common view is that the companies should be taken over by the government, as appears to be happening, and that over time they should be shrunk or broken up into small pieces, reprivatized as smaller companies that aren't too big to fail.
NPR's John Itzy, thanks very much for being with us this morning.
You're very welcome, Scott.